Good afternoon. My name is William Brayshaw, number 208. With me is Mark Isley.
Number 26107.
I would like to reserve 5 minutes or whatever I have left from my opening statements for the rebuttal.
Oh, certainly. I will leave it to you to keep track of your time.
And for purposes of the argument, I'm going to refer to the appellant as the Vessels. I think that was the way that he was referred to. They were referred to in the briefing, and to Mr. Hickerson in this. He will be referred to as Hickerson. Thomas Vessels comes to this court to ask for a reversal of a judgment of the trial court denying Vessels a judgment for the balance due on a promissory note, even though the claim was timely filed under the statute of limitations. The action by the trial court occurred because the trial court made a ruling of first impression in Colorado, and I use the word first ruling of first impression because that's what the trial court referred to it as, that the long-established part payment rule, last confirmed by this court in Drake versus Tyler, that partial payments restart the period of the statute of limitations that could be limited by the equitable doctrine of latches. Prior to trial, Hickerson filed a summary judgment motion claiming that the statute of limitations barred Vessel's claim is untimely. The trial judge at that time was William Hood, and he denied that motion based on the partial payment rule. Latches was not raised by Hickerson in that motion. Trial Judge Hoffman confirmed his approval of Judge Hood's ruling on the motion for summary judgment right at the beginning of trial. He confirmed it in a ruling that he made from the bench, and he confirmed it actually on a ruling on reconsideration in which he reversed his judgment for the Vessels. All of these rulings confirmed that the case was timely filed under the statute of limitations, and that it is not, and that issue is not disputed on appeal. Testimony and other evidence at trial by Vessels focused on the amount due under the note and an accounting for the payments. Hickerson focused on an issue that was first raised at trial, that the promissory note was a non-recourse obligation, and that Hickerson was not personally liable. At the conclusion of the trial, Judge Hoffman ruled that the promissory note was a recourse obligation and entered judgment for the Vessels in an amount in excess of $720,000 plus costs and attorney's fees. The judge also ruled that the defense of latches was not applicable to that transaction.
Mr. Brayshaw, let me interrupt you for a minute. I apologize, but I know what you want us to do here. You want the judgment reversed, but I'm trying to get a clear understanding of what is the rule that you want us to announce in this case. I'm concerned about how broad a rule it is that you may be suggesting and what we should do about it under the circumstances. So tell me the rule that you want us to announce if we were to rule in your favor.
Well, I think the cases in Colorado support the proposition that latches should not be applied to bar a claim, a timely filed claim, under the statute of limitations. I think
any claim.
It's a legal claim, and latches is an equitable defense, and that it should not bar that timely filed claim.
Even a personal injury claim. Any kind of legal claim. That's what you're arguing for, is that latches cannot be applied to bar that claim if it's brought within the statute of limitations.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I think that should be the law in the state. We have also taken a position in our briefing that if latches were to apply, that the essential elements of that defense were not proved or found by the court. But I think that Historically, the courts of this state have said that laches as an equitable defense cannot bar a timely filed claim under the statute of limitations.
Oh, I'm sorry. If I may, Mr. Brayshaw. Well, what happens when you have a claim that's filed within the statute of limitations, but then the plaintiff sits on it? I mean, doesn't a defendant at some point have the opportunity to say, no, you've waited too long? Yeah, you filed your claim, but nothing has happened, and now I've got dead witnesses? Isn't that something that where laches can apply?
Well, I think there are a number of factors that have to be applied there, and as long as the claim is filed within the statute of limitations, it should not be barred by laches. That should not be an issue. I think in any case that you have, witnesses die, even though it could be a year well within the any particular period of the statute of limitations. Witnesses are going to die. They're going to have fuzzy memories. There are a lot of things that happen in the course of a proceeding that could be raised if you start applying laches to start reducing the statute of limitations.
Mr. Brayshaw, so is it your position that laches would never apply because it's equitable and this is a legal claim, or is there more nuance to it?
Well, in the first instance, I said that I don't think that laches should apply to bar a legal claim. The nuances arise if you say the laches applies, then there are a number of different criteria that need to be met that have been actually announced by the Colorado Supreme Court and several times, and that I don't think were found by the judge in this case. But at least at the first instance, I'm saying that by applying laches, in particular in a promissory note case, what happens is that you create a major change in the law, which I think creates a lot of uncertainty as in terms of how that would affect creditors. Whether a promissory note, claim on a promissory note, if it's all subject to the fact that the borrower can claim that somebody can't remember or somebody died, that creates a lot of uncertainty. And I guess the solution that a creditor has is to file a claim much earlier than they might have otherwise filed it. I think that really the position that we have taken is that if this is to be a change in the law, I don't think that the court should make that change. I think the legislature should make the change. The legislature has in its the statute of limitations sections of the statute has recognized that the partial payment rule is there, and it is not the rule on the statute of limitations does not impair the rights of the parties under that partial payment rule that has been, I think, latest announced by Drake versus Tyner.
As I understand the partial payment rule, if there's a partial payment, yet that operates as essentially a new promise or acknowledgement of the debt that starts the statute of limitations running again. Am I correct about
that's
that?
Correct.
So what you had here was a series of years, both before and after the note was finally due, when those payments were made, correct? I mean, payments were made every month.
Pretty much, in fact, payments have been made pretty much every month in every year since the origination of the note, yes.
Including after 1999?
Yes.
Okay, so what do you do then about the trial judge's concern here that, well, if a judge can do that, why can't I do it on the other end and shorten the statute of limitations? What's your response to that?
Well, the idea that Judge Hoffman adopted was that the part payment rule was an equitable rule, And I think his analysis was faulty in the sense that, from an equitable point of view, there was a number of criteria that you have to find before you actually apply that equity. I think our briefs outline what those are. The part payment rule is not subject to that type of analysis. The part payment rule is that if you make the payment, the statute is automatically extended. And there's an interesting aside in the opinion on the statute of limitations issue, because these payments were coming in on a security from oil and gas well down in Louisiana. The payments were coming in regularly. And both Judge Hood and Judge Hoffman held that those payments were just as though Mr. Hickerson was making the payments. You can't appoint an agent and say you didn't know anything about it. So it's just as though Mr. Hickerson was making those payments right up until as long as they are going to be made.
So judges love to do hypotheticals, so let me give you a hypothetical here. The monthly payment was supposed to be around $5,100, as I understand it. And a lot of months, I guess, it was somewhat less than that. What if you had a case where the monthly, the debt, the payments were supposed to be $5,000 a month, and the debtor paid $1 every month? Are you telling me that laches couldn't apply in that circumstance to say, wait a minute, there's just something wrong about this?
Well,
I know that's not our case, but that's why I asked the question to begin with, is what's the scope of the rule that you want us to announce?
Well, see, I think the scope of the rule is that if you start from the proposition that the payments that were coming in every month were basically coming in from Hickerson, he's presumed to know what his agent is doing and that his agent was making all these payments. And so therefore, if you keep on making the payments, and he's presumed to know what the law is, and every time you make a payment, it's going to extend the statute of limitations. If he wanted to interrupt that, then he would have to interrupt the payments. That is Hickerson's solution, is to interrupt him for a period of, in this case, 6 years or whatever the statute would be. Interestingly enough, Judge Hoffman relied on the Churko case and the Teamsters case to support the fact that he had the right to make this application of the doctrine of laches. And I think it's important to point out the Churko case is a copyright case. Copyrights are looked at uniquely in under federal law, and even though they analyzed laches as applied to that case, there was a amount of a money judgment for damages for the copyright violation that was not barred. It was strictly on a finding that there were houses built and owned by third parties that would be impaired if the judge didn't apply laches. And I want to also point out in the Teamsters case, the judge in that case did not apply laches to bar a claim. The judge said that there's a bill here that you owe. You can't reasonably rely on the fact that that they wouldn't come after you on the bill at some point in time, and therefore laches cannot bar that money claim. I'm going to reserve the balance of my time, which is only a few seconds, but I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Certainly, sir. You've got a little over 50 seconds. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Ted Rose, and I'm the attorney for the appellee, Al Hickerson. Registration number is 18098, and Mr. Hickerson is with me. at council table. I'd like to start by following up on a question that Judge Loeb had asked, or a hypothetical. And the issue before this court is a very limited one and a specific one, and that's important because the argument as framed by the appellant invites potentially the court to announce a rule that could be broadly applied in ways that would not be appropriate. The issue before this court is whether a legal claim that is timely, notwithstanding the fact that it is outside of the statute of limitations period, but is timely only because of the application of a judicially recognized principle, the restarting by partial payment principle, is also subject to an analysis by the trial court of whether a countervailing judicially created principle might also be applied, and that is the principle of latches.
Do you have any case anywhere in the United States, the promissory note case, where the court in that case had, and I don't want to even call it extended the statute of limitations, had essentially renewed the statute of limitations because of partial payment, and that very same trial court said, but you know, I'm now gonna forget about what I just did, and I'm gonna shorten the time?
No, Your Honor, nor do I have the cases to the contrary either. And that's why I think Judge Hoffman was correct when he said that, from his perspective, this is a case of first impression in Colorado. But let me explain why we believe that application of latches is appropriate in this circumstance.
Mr. Rosen, before you get there,
yes,
I want to make sure I understand your position on what the partial payment doctrine does. As I read the cases, including Drake, that have been cited by the vessels, it appears that what the partial payment doctrine does in this circumstance is create a new promise. So every payment that was made was a new promise. And theoretically, if you take a look at when the lawsuit was filed, it was filed about a month after a payment was made. So theoretically, aren't we talking about a case that was filed 1 month into the statute of limitations as opposed to years?
Theoretically, I think that that's correct, Your Honor. But as applied, I don't think that that's the correct way to look at it. And let me explain.
Please.
Because the only reason that the partial payment principle applies in this case is if the claim is outside of the original statute of limitations period. In other words, if there was no restarting principle to be applied, then the six-year period would be the automatic cutoff in 2005.
Wouldn't payments between 1999 and 2005 have told the running of the statute?
But yes, but that last word is important, told the statute, because it tolls the statute because of the application of judicially created principles, the partial payment principle being one of them. So if the claim is only arguably timely because of the application of the judicially created partial payment rule, then the question becomes, can the trial court also look to see if another countervailing judicially created principle is equally appropriately applied in the case, and that is latches?
Let me stop you there and ask this question. If you look at the elements of latches, the very first one is unreasonable delay. If you don't have unreasonable delay, as I understand it, you don't even get in the door. So why isn't, when a judge uses a partial payment doctrine, and it's undisputed that there are partial payments, to start the statute of limitations running again, why isn't he essentially saying this period of time is not unreasonable. Isn't that implicit in what the judge is doing? And if that's the case, why would laches in that circumstance ever be applicable as a matter of law?
For this reason, Your Honor, because it's not a zero-sum game. In other words, the fact that the partial payments may restart the running of the limitations period does not determine that the amount of the delay is either reasonable or unreasonable.
I'm not.
Well, let me explain why. Because it, following up on your hypothetical and just making a little twist, if you have a 6-year statute of limitations applicable to a claim, and on the 5th year and 364th day of each of those periods, a dollar is paid by an agent, then on that 5th year and 364th day, the first one of those that occurs, then the limitations period is restarted, arguably. And then, under one hypothetical, or the question you asked, then the delay in waiting to that period to file the claim would not be untimely. But what happens if you engraft onto that a second 5-year 364th day, and then a third, and a fourth, and ad infinitum, until every single party is dead, every witness is dead, all the evidence is spoliated? As you go further and further out into those blocks of time, it becomes more and more germane about how long, how many blocks are you into it, and whether the trial court has the ability to assess, aha, on this third or fourth time that you've waited, whatever it might be, second time, fifth time, I find that application of the judicially created partial payment rule is now trumped by the judicially created laches rule. Because what you've done by continuing to wait this long is stripped the defendant of the ability he would have had to present his defense to the claims that you've asserted. So while I agree in theory with the question that you pose, as you apply that question to certain facts, it becomes less and less appropriate to find that simply one payment during the limitations period or the 6-year block following that, or the 6-year block following that, continues to be, as a matter of law, a reasonable time within to make that payment.
Mr. Rose, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I understand your argument insofar as you are framing this as a restart of the limitations period, as though there is one that keeps getting restarted. Is that what we're talking about, or is the partial payment rule a creation of a new independent statute of limitations, and does that make a difference?
I'm not sure if it makes a difference. I mean, I've analyzed this, and I think the trial court analyzed it in the sense of restarting. So I'd be telling you something that isn't correct if I said I looked at it from a point of view of whether it's a brand new limitations period. I do want to point out that the record suggests payments that were much different than the way that appellant's counsel characterized them. I'm not sure it's going to make a legal difference, but in terms of what happened here, the parties agreed that payment would come from the overriding royalty interest that Mr. Hickerson had in that time in the Louisiana oil and gas well. And that overriding royalty interest was assigned to Vessels Oil and Gas Company, such that the operator of the oil and gas well in Louisiana made payments to Vessels directly. And those payments were not nearly as uniform or in such amounts as I think that appellant's counsel suggested. And the only reason I say that that's important is because one of the elements in the laches analysis that Judge Hoffman applied is whether or not the defendant was on notice of the shortfall in any of these monthly payments. And Judge Hoffman found that because, in fact, from the very execution of the note back in 1989 until the first demand letter in 2007, never once did the appellant notify or advise or communicate in any way with the appellee about the status of repayment. In addition, the original well operator who was sending in the royalty payments to the appellant assigned their interest. So you had a series of different well operators far removed from the original one who were sending the payments to Vessels Oil and Gas. And there were many, many months when no payments were received. Not a $5,000 payment or $1 payment, no payment was received. So I think what we learned from the case law and from Judge Hoffman's opinion is something that Judge Posner talked about in the Teamsters case, and it's kind of a pithy comment, but it's what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. In other words, if the appellant or the plaintiff is coming to a trial court and saying to the trial court, I know I'm beyond the six-year period, but please allow me to avail myself of the judicially created doctrine that enables me to argue my claim is timely, then that same party can't try to strip the trial court of its ability to exercise its discretion and assess whether or not latches is applicable.
Let me challenge you a little bit on that, because I think there's a bit of a disconnect between what Judge Hoffman said Judge Posner was saying and what Judge Posner was actually saying. First of all, does your argument depend on the fact that the partial payment rule was applied in this case? Because in Judge Posner's case, there was no any kind of extension. Right. It was all dicta he was talking about.
I agree, and it does not. Our case is actually strengthened if the court, and it's an easier argument for me to make, that if the court found the payments made simply acted to equitably toll the limitations period. Because if that's what the payments did, if they equitably tolled the limitations period, then my connection to the argument that the trial court has a corresponding ability to determine whether the equitable doctrine of latches should therefore be applied is a much more, I want to say, direct one in certain ways.
But that's clearly not what the law is in Colorado. The law in Colorado seems to be pretty almost black letter law, at least with respect to payments made after the six-year period, that it's not a tolling, it's a brand new cause of action arising with a brand new statute of limitations.
I don't think it's a brand new cause of action, Your Honor. I think it does restart the statute of limitations period, but that the partial payment rule is one of three equitable tolling principles that have been recognized by the court. So the umbrella under which the partial payment rule arose is an equitable tolling umbrella, the other two being one, if the defendant conceals the cause of action from the plaintiff, and the other is that the defendant has promised not to raise statute of limitations as a defense.
What Colorado case says that the partial payment rule is an equitable principle? I can't find one.
Well, an equitable principle in this sense, Your Honor, because I haven't seen a case that says exactly that. An equitable principle in the sense that it is a judicially created principle. It's not something that's a legal claim or a legal principle that you find in a legislative enactment. The partial payment rule is a product of court-created common law. So if that is correct, then the court-created rules with respect to latches should be able to be applied with equal force. The last point I wanted to make is the point, the second issue that the appellants raised, which is that there wasn't sufficient evidentiary findings made by the trial court to support its conclusion that not only could latches be applied in this case, but they should be applied in this case. And I would just refer the court to the extensive findings that Judge Hoffman made in his order on reconsideration, in particular his findings that The best evidence at trial would have been direct testimony from the parties themselves, the two principal signatories to it, Mr. Vessels and Mr. Hickerson. Mr. Vessels had, of course, passed. Mr. Hickerson testified that because 20 years had passed, he couldn't remember it. Doug Hoyt, who was the counsel, the outside counsel for Mr. Hickerson, involved in this case, had passed also. And in addition, no witness was able to testify that they recalled this transaction. Not a witness for the defendants and not a witness for the plaintiffs. So
thank
in these circumstances, we would request that you affirm Judge Hoffman's finding. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Grishaw, you've got 50 seconds.
I just want to address several points. I think it's interesting to note when you look back at the fact that partial payment restarts the statute of limitations. This case was actually filed in January 2009, and if you go back 6 years, where the payments that were being made in 2003 and 2004 actually were extending it well within the period of time that the statute of limitations expired initially. I want to just summarize briefly in just a couple of seconds I have. Judge Hoffman's ruling departs from and is inconsistent with well-established Colorado law recognizing partial payments, extending the statute of limitations. That is clear and certain law that is recognized by the courts and the legislature. It makes and applies new law that is unsupported by any Colorado precedent or even the trial judge's own reasoning. It injects a huge element of uncertainty in the Colorado law that has been unchanged and relied on by countless parties and practitioners for decades. In fact,
Mr. Brayshaw, your time is up.
All right.
Thank you, sir. Counsel, thank you for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.